Welcome to the Frank Reactions podcast, where we discuss how you can get great reactions from your staff, your customers, prospects, and the public through better customer experiences online and off. My name is Tema Frank. If you've already heard my blurb about how we've been transitioning from Frank Online Marketing to Frank Reactions, feel free to just skip ahead to about the 2-minute mark. Otherwise, listen on. We've been transitioning gradually from the Frank Online Marketing Show to the Frank Reactions podcast over the last few weeks, but there's a fair amount of overlap because many of the companies that I interviewed on that show were being successful online because of how they were handling customer experience related issues. So I think there's a lot of insight there that listeners to this podcast can also benefit from. What I've decided to do is for the first few episodes, I'm actually going to replay some of the ones from Frank Online Marketing that really deal a fair bit with customer experience related issues. So if you are a longtime listener of the Frank Online Marketing Show and have already heard all those, I would suggest you just skip right ahead to episode 15, which is where we will have totally new, fresh content for you. If you're interested, particularly in the online marketing side of things, I'd also suggest that you go back to the Frank Online Marketing Show and check out those episodes because there's a lot of real value in those as well. So next up is today's interview, and I hope that I'll get some feedback from you about what you think. I'd really be grateful if you would do a review on iTunes. It would be really exciting if we could get listed in their new and noteworthy column. And it would also be gratifying for me just to know that you're out there listening and to hear some of what you have to say about the show, because I am always looking for ways to make it better. Here we go. Have you ever been disappointed by one of the big hit business books? You know, you go, you've heard everyone talking about it, it's a bestseller like crazy, and you pick it up and you realize there's nothing new in it and it's really pretty superficial. Well, sometimes the opposite also happens. You'll stumble across a business book that you hadn't heard about by an author you haven't heard about and discover that it really gets you thinking. For me, one of these books is a new one by a fellow named Chuck Blakeman, and the book is called Why Employees Are Always a Bad Idea. He has written a previous book called Making Money is Killing Your Business, which was the number one rated business book of the year in 2010 by the National Federation for Independent Business. I really found reading both of these books that what Chuck has to say makes so much sense. And really what he's talking about is how our society has shifted from, or is in the process of shifting from, an industrial age model to a participation age model. And he talks about why that's happening and how to make that work in your company. I remember when I was studying my undergraduate business degree way back in the late 1970s, and one of the people that we had to study was Frederick Winslow Taylor, founder of Taylorism as it became known. And Chuck really rants a lot about Taylor because he blames a lot of our attitudes about employees on Taylor, who basically and quite openly admitted that in his mind, employees were stupid and lazy and had to be controlled and made to work hard. Whereas my view has always been, no, if you give people an opportunity, they're likely to rise to the challenge. I like the way Chuck describes it in his book. He talks about the Taylorist model treats employees as children. And Chuck calls the workplace an adult daycare center. His view is we need to start treating people as adults. And the reason he says no employees is because in his mind, they need to be turned into stakeholders, not just employees. And so essential to that is, in fact, a concept of everybody in a company participating in profit sharing. So I know for some of you that may be enough to just make you say, not going to work for my company. But I would really urge you to listen to this interview and afterwards probably to pick up his books. Here we go. I will chat with you briefly at the end of the interview, and I really look forward to your feedback on this one.
Chuck Blakeman, and my company is the Crankset Group. We provide 3 to 5 clubs for business owners, and that's 24 business owners in a group twice a month working on their businesses together to get a life and get a business at the same time. I've started 8 companies, and they've been all across the board from technology, database development, branding and marketing, a fulfillment call center, printing direct mail, even a stray landscape architecture thing 30 years ago.
You've had quite the variety, and you also travel and do stuff in Africa, I gather.
Yes.
Chuck, one of the things that has struck me in reading both of your books now is, and the reason I wanted to interview you, is that we both, I think, share the belief that to deliver great customer service, you need to have things working smoothly internally. And that means both systems and people. Now, the title of your second book contains a very provocative idea, and that is, employees are always a bad idea. Why?
Employees are always a bad idea because employees are an invented concept. They were invented for the industrial age. They were a bad idea then, and they're a bad idea now. They're a worse idea now. Even when it worked, it was a bad idea. And the reason it's a bad idea is because it creates an artificial construct, an artificial hierarchy between some people and other people. And worse, the real reason that employees are always a bad idea is because the fundamental definition of an employee comes from Frederick Winslow Taylor in 1911. He wrote a paper called Scientific Management, and he defined what an employee is. Have you heard of that paper?
Yes, I have. I remember studying it when I did my undergraduate business degree.
Yeah, Taylor did a lot of good stuff, but he wrecked it all with two fatal assumptions about people. Fatal assumption number one was they're stupid. And he says the average employee is so stupid, I have this memorized, which is sad, but the average employee is so stupid he more resembles the ox than any other type. And the second fundamental assumption he makes about people is that they're lazy. And he calls it soldiering, that the average employee will work only so much as to not get fired. And if that's your fundamental assumption about people, there's only one way to solve that. And that is to find a rare few smart and motivated people to take care of all the stupid and lazy ones. And thus, management was born.
Right.
Management is not a 10,000-year-old concept. Leadership is. But management is a invented construct for the industrial age. And you know, you find what you're looking for. Taylor wanted stupid people. He didn't want lazy ones, but he wanted stupid ones. And to call them lazy helped build the thing around a system designed by geniuses to be run by idiots. So that's why they're a bad idea. It dehumanizes people.
And he wanted stupid in the sense that he didn't want people who were going to get bored running assembly lines.
That's right. Yeah. People who would be willing to do an idiot's job, put a nut on a bolt for 35 years and go home and go bowling. That's what he was looking for. And he even said it a number of times, the perfect employee is more like an ox. And an ox is pretty stupid. They're just really strong. So he wanted strong, stupid people. And you know, the fascinating thing, here's the other reason why employees are always a bad idea. The most human of questions, there's who, what, when, why, where, and how, and all those. The most human of those, of course, is why.
Yeah.
And what was the one question you couldn't ask during the industrial age factory system? Why?
That's why.
Yeah, we don't want humans to come to work. We just want extensions of machines. Let's strip the humanity out of this. Let's make you into an idiot. We're the geniuses, and off we go. So it wasn't a good idea when it worked, and it's a worse idea now, and the millennials aren't any different motivation than the rest of us, the research has shown. It's just that they don't have the shadow of the industrial age hanging over them, telling them to take an idiot's job. So they're just not going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, that is a really interesting point about them not having had that exposure to that industrial age and not having had exposure to this whole belief that if I'm good to the company for 30 years, they'll be good to me in retirement.
Right, the Ozzie and Harriet myth.
Exactly. These people have grown up seeing their parents work hard and get laid off. So that certainly brings about a change. Now, you know, I'm certainly inclined to agree that the vast majority are not stupid and lazy, on the contrary. But what about employees who really are stupid or lazy?
And there are those. The research shows, you know, that Gallup did all this engagement, disengagement stuff. And I'm always suspect when we start getting into business buzzword bingo. But but they did some real good research, and another company did the same thing, found the same thing out, that 20% of people who go to work are inherently what we would call stakeholders. That is, they want to be adults. They want to own their job, own their task, own their process, own everything going into their business. And they want to own the result as well. But another 20% are incorrigible employees. That is, they want to be children. They want to be told what to do. They don't want to take responsibility. Then there's the great unwashed middle in the, which is the 60%. And those people in the 60% in the middle, they will go either way depending on what you treat them like. And that's why we think that most people are stupid and lazy, is because we do have the 80-20 rule in effect. We've right. got 20% of people who will not sit down, shut up, sit down and be quiet. They're going to ask why no matter what. And in an industrial age company, we find them annoying. In a participation age company, we value them and say, boy, didn't we get lucky.
Yes.
The fact is, though, that we set up an environment, a system designed by geniuses to be run by idiots, and you hire me, and I look around and I see, okay, I get this game. At home, I'll be an adult, but here I'm going to live in a Dilbert society, and my job is to be stupid and lazy and make you look smart and motivated. And so I really believe strongly that 80% of the workforce, 20% is already a stakeholder, and 60% more want to be there, and it will take us anywhere from 5 minutes to 2 years to get somebody turned around based on how much industrial age noise they have in their head.
Sure. Now, I got into a little bit of a debate with someone on LinkedIn yesterday where we were talking about, he was making the claim that there's nothing, that jobs, if they're well-defined jobs, should inherently give you a sense of value if you're doing your job well. And I was saying, well, okay, what about how do you give someone that sense that they're being valuable if they're doing a telemarketing job selling something that they know most people won't want? How do you deal with some situations like that?
That's the fallacy in his argument. If you are inventing a rocket ship, that's inherently motivating.
Right.
But there's a lot of other stuff that has to get done in the world that isn't inherently motivating. We have what we call 3 to 5 clubs that meet on a regular bi-monthly basis, and we have someone who brings the refreshments. We pay them to bring the refreshments and lay them out exactly like we want them, and then to do the data entry. And those things all by themselves are not inherently motivating. So there has to be something bigger than that that will motivate them. And the number one thing that the most powerful motivator in business for anybody is ownership. And really probably in life. When I was in kindergarten and all the 30 kids had shoes lined up against the wall, I saw mine. And I saw my little nap rug. And when I see my bike rack, I see my bike. I don't see anybody else's bike. Mm-hmm. Ownership is a very powerful thing. And right. we need to figure out how to get everybody to the point where they can be owners. They don't have to be physical owners of the company. But can they own the decisions that affect them? Can they own the processes that affect them? Can they own the tasks, the teamwork, and the profit-sharing result of their work? When you get those kinds of things going, somebody will schlep groceries for you and be really excited to do it, because we're helping them. It's what we call making meaning, not just money.
Okay, so you've got two different concepts in there that I want to touch on. One is the profit sharing, and we'll get back to that. But the other, you said, can they own the tasks and the processes of their job? But what if they aren't necessarily tasks and processes that involve a lot of other people? Who owns it?
Then they would own it together with the other people who are affected by it. One of the principles that we use in what we call a participation age company, which replaces all this industrial age nonsense, is that decisions should be made at the level at which they will have to be lived with.
Amen.
So this decision affects only me. You know, whether I use a yellow pencil or a green pencil, then I make that decision. Mm-hmm. But if it affects more than me, then I need to get involved those people, and we need to make that decision. It's not necessarily consensus all the time, because consensus can really slow you down. But you involve other people in the decision-making process. So, for instance, a classic example of me acting like an industrialist instead of a participation age capitalist, we were supposed to buy a copier for our office. And we got 3 or 4 people involved in that discussion. And Lauren does about 95-98% of the copying. So, of course, she was involved in the discussion. But I just went out after getting some input from her and other people. We had 3 or 4 copiers that we were looking at. I just went out and got one. And brought it back, and it was the biggest, baddest one of the bunch. Went the fastest, did the best colors, the whole thing. And I brought it back, and I could see the look on Lauren's face. It was like, what in God's name is that?
Uh-oh.
And what I realized was I had just violated what I had said, that decisions should be made at the level that will have to be lived with. Well, guess what? Every time that thing falls or breaks down on us, who's she mad at? Me.
Right.
I should have given that decision to her. I shouldn't even have given her a budget. I said, just go get one. And then and the upshot of that is she would have picked one that was about three times cheaper than the one I picked.
So why do you think you did that?
Because I'm 59 years old and I'm dealing with a lot of industrial age nonsense in my head. But okay. Even though I know the principles, I find myself violating them on a regular basis. That's really the biggest reason. And then, of course, all that comes with the industrial age nonsense is, well, I'm smarter and more motivated than she is, when in fact she's going to have to use this thing. She's a lot more smarter and motivated when it comes to copiers. But I just reflexively go there because we have 150 years worth of this nonsense called management in our
right. head. Yeah. So you mentioned a consensus, and that consensus is not necessarily a good way to try and manage things.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that, and what is the alternative?
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot of companies out there that are what we would call participation age companies. One of my favorites is one that you've probably heard of in Brazil called Semco, run by Ricardo Semler. And he runs a company that where there's no managers. And so you look at his book that he wrote on this, and Ricardo Semler's book on how he built his business in Brazil shows why consensus is a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
What you find is that he worked really hard making unilateral decisions on his own to create a very democratic work.
Yes.
And so it's ironically, yes, it's a good thing to push decisions to the level at which they have to be lived with, and a lot of times that just results in just teams of people making decisions, and they have to work it out. But if they can't work it out, somebody needs to be able to break the tie. And
right.
It may not even be somebody on the team. So the best form of business is what I would call a benevolent dictatorship. And that's exactly what Ricardo Semler had. He had it as his highest priority to build a democratic environment where decisions were made at the level they would be lived with. And he was going to use all of his dictatorial powers to make sure that happened. And I guarantee you, if anybody decided that they were going to go back and create an industrial age company out of this, if the consensus of the company that was going to happen, he'd fire anybody who had that mindset. So,
well, and in fact, he did right when he first took over. Yeah, he fired most of the managers.
Yeah, it was like 60%. I think he fired 60% of them in the first week, and it took him 8 years to get rid of the rest of them. That's how insidious management is.
Yes. Now, I mean, his company is a very interesting one, and it's a high-profile example of where this participation age management has worked. But there aren't a lot of examples. I know there are starting to be more, but and I can see where in a small company it's fairly easy to implement a system that provides that kind of participation and that kind of flexibility of decision making and even the profit sharing. But how do you make that work in a large company?
Well, and again, you do have Ricardo Semler as a shining example. And I like that one because it was started in 1951 as a classic industrial age factory. Mm-hmm. He took it over in 1981, 30 years old later, and turned it around. So he took one that was industrial age and made it into participation age. Then you have, and that's 3,000 stakeholders. That's big. But you know, you could
and just to clarify for the listeners, stakeholder is the term you use instead of employees.
Yeah,
right?
Because employees are a bad idea. We don't even use the term. We've replaced it with employees are children, stakeholders are adults. Thank you.
Okay.
Adult owner. And but so if you had that as the only example, then you could say, well, yeah, you know, they're freaks. And it's all because he was uber talented. But then you've got W.L. Gore here in the United States, another high profile example. They have 10,000 stakeholders. There's not a single manager in the whole place. People have been quoted there saying if anybody here ever told anybody else what to do, they'd never work with them again. And that's 10,000 of them. And then you have other companies that are technology companies that are smaller but moving in that direction. Tony Hsieh's organization has some of those. But you have a lot of companies like TD Industries, Whole Foods, Wegmans. Wegmans turnover is under 3%. And it's not a consensus environment, but they push decisions to the level at which they should be lived with, and they flatten the structure as much as they can. And in an industry where 35% is the normal turnover, theirs is under 3. And we can just go on with other companies that are doing it, newer companies that are getting there as well. Companies like Total Renal Care out of Los Angeles, nobody's heard of them, but they've got a few hundred people. World Blue is trumpeting a lot of those kinds of companies. This is a tidal wave of companies getting on board. W.L. Gore started in 1959 and has been doing this since then. So we can say it's time tested. We've got Gore, we've got Semco, we've got a number of others that are 30 plus years old saying this works. We can show them in almost every major industry segment, and we can show them of every size, and we can show them of every age. So what more proof does somebody need that this is a good idea?
What are the typical barriers to implementing this type of system? I mean, obviously, there are the attitudes. People aren't used to it.
Yeah, but before you even get to their attitudes, that's certainly one, is that you've got people who have 158 years worth of industrial age noise in their heads. That's a obstacle. But before you even get to that, there's two bigger ones. Number one is the belief system of the people who are in leadership.
Yep.
Ricardo Semler says he regularly gets people traipsing down to Brazil to look at his company. And he says they all come back and nobody can ever implement what he did. And he says the reason is because they only take bits and pieces of what he did, and they try and do self-directed work teams, which was a big deal in the 1980s that didn't work because all the people above them wouldn't do the same thing. The world of hypocrisy and on and on. But what he really missed there was the reason that they don't do it is that they're making a fatal assumption that they should study Ricardo Semler's company when in fact they should study Ricardo Semler's head. Because that's what made Semco what it is. What does Ricardo Semler believe? That's the number one impediment to making this work. The belief systems of those in charge. If you even subtly believe that the people under you are somehow less smart and less motivated than you are, you create an environment where that's true. Then, so let's say you've got someone who says, all right, I get it. I believe everybody's smart and motivated. The second biggest problem is the same one that Semler ran into, and that is managers. Managers are industrial age fiefdom builders whose job is to create something and accumulate it for themselves so that they justify their existence by how big their budget is and how many people they have. Have you ever heard, Tema, of a manager go to their supervisor or to the company and say, hey, I just thought of a great idea how to put my department out of business? It's never happened. So until you have belief systems in place and a commitment to eliminate managers, you'll pick off pieces of this and you can still be better off than you were, but you won't ever get where Gore, Semco, and a lot of others have gotten.
Okay, so you've just touched on, you know, one of my other questions was going to be, is it feasible to sort of do a pilot in part of the organization as a way of convincing others that this is the way to go?
Yeah, I think you could if the organization was big enough that thing could run autonomously without interruption and without interaction with the rest of the company, you absolutely could.
Okay, that's a good point. And I guess I could also see, I mean, you've stated that profit sharing is a crucial part of this. And how would that work then with a public company?
Sure. And I put this in the book. Public companies are in a lot of trouble going forward. As the industrial age wanes and the participation age grows, the hardest company to adapt to this will be public companies. But I could give you a few examples of public companies that do it really well. The impediments for them are the biggest one obviously is that their job is supposed to be to make money for the shareholders and not the stakeholders. And so the shareholders are going to resist that the stakeholders would run off with some of the profits. But if you look at the companies that are doing this, they are all more profitable than the industrial age companies that fear it. The firms of endearment, there's 30 companies on the Fortune 500 list. When you ask this crazy question in the Fortune 500s, which Raj Sisodia did in his book, Firms of Endearment, is there anybody out there who has making money as their second priority and something else as their first priority as a public company? Crazy notion, because of course their first priority is supposed to be to make money for their stakeholders. He found 30. And those 30 make 1,072% on average more than the average S&P 500 company. So if you want to make a bucket load of money, you better get on board with the idea that participation age is here. The other reason you have to have profit sharing, Tim, is simply this. You can't say to someone, okay, you own your process, you own your task, your process, your job, your teamwork, your results, you own all of that stuff, you even own your decision making, but I'm going to keep the money.
Mm-hmm.
It all falls apart there. If you don't profit share as well, then if you don't put them in a results-based world, and that's the key cultural shift, is to move from time-based to results-based, you're not gonna make this happen.
Mm-hmm. So how do you determine what is an appropriate share then if you're going to be doing profit sharing?
Yeah, that's just all over the board. That's sort of one of those it depends things. It depends on the company and what motivates people and what motivates the owners of the company to still keep going. And so there's everything in there, but it's more the principle of the thing. It's not just the principle. You can't give somebody 3 cents and call it. But it's really, do I truly own a piece of my results? When I get a good result, do I get to see that come back to me in the way of a raise and a profit sharing or things like that? Do I get to be part of it? Broil King in Toronto, fairly large company making shiny aluminum or stainless steel barbecues.
Yeah.
They put in place a profit sharing program that included all 1,000 or so of the people that worked there, and it was very simple. When they send out a barbecue, they put like $30 in the pot for everybody. Mm-hmm. And let's say there's like 150 people working there. And those 150 people, from the CEO to the guy who sweeps the floors, all share in that. So let's say it's 100 people, so they all get 1%.
Okay.
Of that $30. And every time a barbecue comes back and needs to be repaired under warranty, they take that money out of the kitty. So 10 go out at $300, $30 each. So $300 goes in the pot. One comes back and it costs $200 to fix it. There's now only $100 left in the pot to split. They put that program in place and instantly their returns went to almost nothing. and the end result is that the people across the board maybe make an extra $500 a year doing that. But they watch this. They put up a big board in the warehouse that shows here's how much money came in, here's how much is going out. And every time one of these comes back in, they subtract. And so it's highly visible and it's on everybody's mind. That's just a great example of one type of profit sharing that is highly motivating to people.
Well, and I guess, one of the thoughts going through my mind is, okay, so let's say you're on a team like that. At some level, somebody's got to be thinking about potentially firing people who aren't pulling their weight. Right. How does that work? Because I can see people getting annoyed if it's one person who's screwing up over and over again.
I think the irony of this is the bigger the company is, the easier this is. And Semco and Gore and TD Industries and a number of others are really great examples of this. They split themselves up into self-directed work teams, except everybody lives on one of those, not just the people at the bottom. There's no bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody lives in a work team, and every 6 months or so, at Gore, for instance, every 6 months, the 10 or 15 people on that team get together and vote on who gets to stay on the island. Now, it's a it's a blind vote. Nobody has to, but, if you only get maybe 7 out of 12 favorable, and you get that twice in a row, you're gone. And they also vote on each other's salaries, so there's no manager needed for that. Here's the salary pool available to this team. It's, $800,000. There's 12 of you. And they vote on who gets what.
So how does that work? I mean, we've seen CEO salaries rise to ridiculous levels.
Yeah.
Do these CEOs of companies like this just accept making less?
Well, they do. And in some cases, again, there's a benevolent dictatorship in there, so there's always a piece of that. But, for instance, at Whole Foods, I believe John Mackey simply said, he put a formula in place. He said, my salary will never be more than, I think it's like 14 times the lowest paid person, a full-time person at this place. So if John wants a raise, he gives the guy at the bottom of the raise, and he gets 14 times that. It's pretty motivating to mm-hmm. give the guy at the bottom a raise. The other piece you have to understand about this, and again, this is where publicly traded companies have a disadvantage in this, is that if I own a, like John Mackey, if I own a $500 million a year company, I own 20% of that. I'm going to get, you know, maybe a $250,000 a year salary, but then I'm also going to get distributions that make me a bazillionaire.
Right.
So, you know, I still get plenty of money off of this, and I have the same thing with my company. We own a majority of it. We take a pretty low salary, but we make plenty of money through the distribution. So, but it's a great way to keep ourselves on par with everybody else around us. So profit sharing and decision making, you find that works if you split it up. If you get rid of the manager, what happens is those 10 people take the 40% of what the manager was doing that was actually valuable, split it amongst themselves, and keep going.
So how does this sort of thing work when the economy slumps and when sales take a dive, profits take a dive? How do you maintain morale?
It works better because people are highly motivated by their results. They're not getting them. SEMCO, their turnover is less than 1% a year, 3,000 stakeholders, 20 to 25 people a year leave that company.
Although, as somebody pointed out to me, it's in a country with a very high unemployment and poverty rate.
Yeah. And they're obviously, you know, they've got something that's working, but Brazil had a 10-year depression. And during that 10-year depression, SEMCO grew 600%.
Yeah.
Our company went from, we run on the same thing. There's only five full-time people here and three or four full-time people around the U.S. and then about eight part-time people. So we got about 20 folks. Mm-hmm. And we run the same way. No managers, no titles, none of that stuff. And we grew 409% between 2009 and 2013. We didn't have time for the recession. Everybody's on board. We just kept going.
You've just touched on another thing I wanted to ask you about, because many years ago, I wrote a book about Canada's best employers for women, and which, of course, turned out to be the best employers for men as well, even though the reverse isn't always true.
That's right.
But one of the key elements is flexibility of work time, work location, and basically compensating people based on results rather than face time.
You got it.
So, and as I recall from reading your books, you were basically advocating no set hours, no set vacation days. You just leave it up to people. And I think Semler does this too. Leave it up to people to determine what they think is appropriate and do what they think is appropriate. So how does that work out in practice?
Yeah, the key thing here is that one of the differences between a participation age company and an industrial age company, and I use the word industrial age meaning that right now today there are a lot of high technology companies, and I would put Yahoo in this boat, that are operating like industrial age companies. So there's no smokestack, but they got all the front office business practices. One of the big differences between those two is that the industrial age company is time based.
Yeah.
Marissa Mayer made everybody come back into the adult daycare center.
Yeah, that shocked me. It really did.
It was a total misfire on her part. It was a management move, not a leadership move.
Yeah.
And a participation age company is results based. So we took a law firm that was 39 people doing $9 million a year. That was, you know, law firms talk about time based.
Yes.
We, a year and a half later, it took about a year and a half, almost 2 years for them to turn it around. They became a results-based company. They looked at everybody and said, what result should we all be getting? Everybody got metrics. And they said, if you get that metrics, we don't care where you are or when you are.
Mm-hmm.
It is that result. And in 2 years, they went from, 18-year-old company that had been hovering around $10 million a year. They went from $9 million and 39 people to 16 million and 60 people in 2 years. And the two founders, here's the cap. Oh, two more things. Everybody there now works 7.5 hours less per day than they did 2 years ago on average.
Wow.
But wait, there's more. The two founders who never got more than a week off per year for 18 years now take 5 months off each every year.
Whoosh.
Almost 2 weeks a month off, and then they take a month in the summers, both of them. So there's a great example of how a participation age switch can help you build your business.
So why are companies so resistant to this? Like, all the evidence suggests that this is the way to go and that it is so much more profitable and more successful and leads to saner lives. Why is there still this feeling that this is kind of a fringe, wacko idea?
Two things. The bigger you get, the more you have to protect. It's already working. Leave it alone. It's working for me.
Right.
So the upward funnel of the giant hierarchy that came out of the industrial age worked really well for J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller, and all those dudes. The people at the bottom are getting crushed. But as long as it works for me, why would I mess with what's working? The second reason is that, and again, this goes to why publicly traded companies will have more trouble, but the bigger you are, the more trouble you have, because the bigger you are, the more likely you are, unfortunately, to make decisions based in the short term rather yes. than the long term.
Well, and especially publicly traded
yeah,
companies.
So you'll sell off your best unit to look good for 3 months while you're getting bought.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Great for the next 3 months, horrible for the next 20 years. So that's the biggest reason is they haven't found any good reason to change. This is still working for me at the top, and I make all my decisions based on the short term, and this is going to make me really – this is going to make us great for the long term, but it might actually hurt my bottom line for 3 months or 2 years. I'm not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to take a while for people – once those industrial age companies begin to study closely the Gores and the Semcos and the Whole Foods and the TV industries that are making bucket loads of money doing this, that will get them going. There's only two motivations to do this. One is, as an industrialist, I'm going to make a bucket load more money. But the other is, I'm altruistic and I want to leave a legacy where I built a business that made a bucket load of money and people made meaning as well. They liked working here.
Mm-hmm.
That's what John Mackey, that's what motivated him and a number of others to go this direction. And they make more money too.
Yeah. When you're talking about a large-ish company, it doesn't even have to be enormously large, but larger than 100 people, let's say,
uh-huh.
you're likely to have a lot of processes. And part of making this work is process mapping.
Yeah.
Figuring out how do things work? How can we make them work more efficiently? How do you tackle that kind of challenge if you're moving over a company that's already sizable?
That's a great question. When people don't hear my whole story, they think that I'm a fan of chaos. I'm not. If you read my first book, which you did, you find out that process mapping is one of the ways that we encourage people to actually create a participation age company.
Mm-hmm.
And processes that people run create consistency for them, for the customers. It makes things run smoother, more efficiently. I'm a big fan of processes. Here's the problem. In a corporation like you're describing, if you're trying to make that switch, all of the processes that are being run right now were designed by the geniuses to be run by the idiots.
Mm-hmm.
And so to make this switch, the first thing you'd do is you'd go to them and say, okay, we're wiping the slate clean. Let's forget about the process to begin with. And let's focus on the result. What result do we all agree we need to get in order for this company to make bucket loads of money and make the meaning and all that? So what's the result? So we focus on the results, and then we give that to that team of people and say, okay, if you believe you can get us the result, let's sign on the dotted line. We're all in for this result. Now we want you to go away and design a process that will get us that result. And bring that process back to us so you're not out of the loop as the leaders in the company. It's not chaos. It's not anarchy. Bring the process back to us. And if we're absolutely sure that parts of what you're doing are going to help sink the ship, then we're probably going to step in. If we don't like your process as a participation age company, I'm probably going to let you run it, and I'm going to watch your metrics really closely. And if
yeah.
you're not hitting your metrics, I'm going to challenge your process. But what happens more often than not is the people running the process, gee, what a surprise. If we would let the so-called idiots design the process, we would have found out they were geniuses. And so redesign an entire company on the back of that, and that creates ownership at a level that you would have never had before. We created this process, and we own it.
Absolutely. That makes total sense to me. Okay, so from what you have written and said, the most important thing, I guess, to start with is making sure you've got a really concise, motivating vision, mission, what words you want to use,
yeah.
something compelling that motivates your whole team. Is that correct?
Yeah, two things. You need to first understand what you believe. And that's
right.
What I say in my second book, Why Employees Are Always a Bad Idea. What do you believe as a leader? Ricardo Semler said, I believe that people want to be adults. That was one of his two fundamental beliefs about the world around him. And he built a company based on that belief. And so when you figure out what you believe, you start making every decision based on that. And then your vision comes from that belief. If I believe this, then what do we as a company, what kind of value do we want to add in the world around us? And that becomes your vision. And it has to be compelling enough for people to want to jump on board with it. Most vision and mission statements sound like they were put together just, you know, to paste into a annual statement. Yeah. We're going to be the number one pencil manufacturer. And we're going to use all our customers to do it. You know, it's just,
right.
There's nothing better. So yeah, it's really important that you understand what you believe, that you communicate to everybody what you believe, because that is your culture. Jason Fried, who wrote the book Rework, 37 Signals, I love what he said. He said, you don't create a culture. You just live out what you believe, and what you believe gets lived out in your daily decisions, and that becomes your culture.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Is there anything else I should have asked you and haven't? I mean, I've taken a lot of your time already, but...
One thing we should have covered is replacing managers with leaders. We need to replace employees with stakeholders. We need to replace the children with adults. How do we get rid of managers? And the way we do that is we replace them with leaders. And when you do that, you find out you probably need about one leader for every 5 to 10 managers. You don't need a lot of them. Because leaders, you know, managers get in the soup and do all the decision making, and leaders train other people to solve their own problems. They give guidance, they give vision, they give training, they give support, they connect people with resources, they use their authority as benevolent dictators to make other people successful, and then they get the heck out of the way. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that is important in this whole process. Sure, employees need to become stakeholders, but in order for that to happen, managers become leaders, and as I say in the book, the art of leadership is to figure out how few decisions the leader should make.
So it requires a different way of training and thinking for the leaders.
Yeah, you have to believe
well.
the other people are smart and motivated.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I've seen that. I remember way back in one of my earliest jobs, and the first time I actually had a secretary of my own, that tells you how long ago it was. We weren't supposed to do our own typing, and I never acknowledged that I knew how, because otherwise everyone would expect me to. But I had this young secretary, and I said to her, okay, I'd like you to draft a letter. And she was quite shocked, like, me, I don't know how to do this. And I said, well, you know, give it a try and let's see. And she just thrived after other people had told me this woman was stupid and lazy, basically.
Yeah.
She wasn't. It was just no one had ever given her an opportunity to do something motivating.
Tamara, real quick, one of the intrinsic values of human beings is that they're intrinsically creative. And when you give someone a problem to solve, all they're doing is being creative. It gives them an opportunity to be human. So that's what she did. She had a problem. She didn't know how to fix it. You gave her the trust and the belief that she could do it. And she got to be a human being. She got to create. Cool deal.
Yeah. Well, Chuck, I find this all so very exciting because, as I said to you in my email, it's stuff that I've been preaching for a heck of a long time. And it's exciting to see that, at least in some companies, it's starting to happen. And I think it's going to be more and more of them.
Yeah, I think one of the encouraging things for me is to find more and more people like you and other pieces of the movement like this. Because if you do this all by yourself, you're just a fringe idea. But when you're regularly finding other people who have been walking this way for a long period of time, you know that what you're involved in is a movement. And it's just a matter of a very short time before that movement breaks out. That's why we wanted to get this book out, Why Employees Are Always a Bad Idea. We wanted to get it out fast because I think 5 to 10 years from now, this is going to be a big duh.
There's no question that in the sort of model proposed in this book, there are a certain percentage of employees, and Chuck estimates that it's about 20%, who will likely end up leaving your organization, either voluntarily or through being fired, because they simply don't want to pull their weight. But for the other 80%, you can create something truly awesome and truly profitable. There is a growing body of research that demonstrates that. And what amazed me and excited me even before I came across Chuck and his book was discovering Ricardo Semler and his company in Brazil called Semco. And if you're not familiar with that, Google it, look it up. It's awesome. This guy inherited a company that was a very traditional manufacturing company. Well, his father actually brought him into the business when Ricardo had finished university. And Ricardo was going crazy. He couldn't stand the bureaucracy. He was appalled by the games playing going on. And after a little while, he said to his dad, you know what? This isn't right for me. I'm sorry. I'm going to quit and I'm going to go do my own thing somewhere else. His father, who I guess was feeling ready to retire, said to him, no, you're not going to do that. If you really believe you've got a better way to do things, go ahead. I'm stepping back. The company is yours. Do whatever you think is right. Well, within the first couple of weeks, he fired most of the senior management team, and I'm sure the father was just wondering what the heck he had done. But the company, restructured as Ricardo did it, has gone on to become incredibly successful. It continues to grow and has continued to grow steadily despite all the ups and downs in the Brazilian economy. That's probably one of the biggest shining examples, but there are others. And I think it may not be in 5 or 10 years, the way Chuck said at the end, but I really think this is the way we're going to move. Partially because, as he pointed out, millennials are not used to operating in the industrial era. They are used to being in a more participative structure, and they are going to demand it. That's the way things will evolve, and those are the companies that will be the successful ones. At least, that's what I believe. What do you think?
I'd really love to get your feedback on today's episode. You can always reach me by email, Tema, T-E-M as in marketing, A, at frankreactions.com. You can always leave me a telephone message on our toll-free line, which is 1-866-544-9262. If you'd like to check out the other episodes or the blog, visit frankreactions.com, and you can always subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you would be so kind as to put a review in iTunes, that would be absolutely awesome, because then other people can also discover this show more easily. You can also, of course, find me on Twitter at Tema Frank and all the other basic social media places. I look forward to chatting with you again in 2 weeks.